welcome. This is the first podcast of LostHistory.com. It's a website dedicated to religious history and comparative mythology. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to just start off and give five quotes. I'm not going to name the sources for the quotes until I'm finished with all of them, but what I'd like you to do is just bear with me and listen to them and try to provide your own context for the quotes. All right, first quote. "Indeed, I am the Son of God, and concerning me the prophet Isaiah spoke, saying, Behold, a virgin shall conceive and will give birth to a son, and will be called Emmanuel. Did I not form myself in the heaven, earth, sea, and all things contained therein? Then they all answered and said, Make known by some sign, and show by a miracle that thou art God. He answering said, Bring hither to me a dead man, and I will restore him to life. The people made haste, and having dug into a certain sepulchre, found there nothing but dry bones. And when they told him that they had found only bones, he said, Bring them here. And when they were brought, he put all the bones together, and covered them with skin, flesh, and nerves. So he that had been a dead man stood up on his feet alive." All right, here's the second quote. "For, O people in Zion, who dwell in Jerusalem, surely you shall not weep any more. He will certainly be gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears, he will answer you. And though the Lord gives you the bread of affliction and the water of oppression, your teacher will no longer hide himself. And your eyes will see your teacher. And your eyes will hear a word behind you saying, This is the way. Walk in it." Now for the third quote. "And you will utter the decree, and it will be established for you, and light will shine on your ways. When they cast you down, you shall say, There is a lifting up, for he saves the lowly. He delivers the unclean. Yes, he will deliver you by your clear hands." All right, moving on to the next quote. "What advantage do the Athenians gain from putting Socrates to death? Famine and plague came upon them as a judgment for their crime. What advantage did the men of Samos gain from burning Pythagoras? In a moment their land was covered with sand. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that their kingdom was abolished. God justly avenged these three wise men. The Athenians died of hunger. The Samians were overwhelmed by the sea. The Jews, ruined and driven from their land, live in complete dispersion. But Socrates did not die for good. He lived on in the teaching of Plato. Pythagoras did not die for good. He lived on in the statue of Hera. Nor did the wise king die for good. He lived on in the teaching which he had given." All right, and here's the last quote. "A voice from the east, a voice from the west, a voice from the four winds, a voice against Jerusalem and the holy house, a voice against the bridegrooms and the brides, and a voice against the whole people. This was his cry as he went about by day and by night, in all the lanes of the city. However, certain of the most eminent among the populace had great indignation at this dire cry of his, and took up the man, and gave him a great number of stripes. Yet did he not he either say anything for himself, or anything peculiar to those who chastised him, but still went on with the same words with which he cried before. Hereupon our ruler, supposing, as the case proved to be, that this was a sort of divine fury in the man, brought him to the Roman procurator, where he was whipped until his bones were laid bare. Yet he did not make any supplication for himself, nor shed any tears, but turning his voice to the most lamentable tone possible at every stroke of the whip, his answer was, Woe, woe to Jerusalem. And when Albinus, for he was then our procurator, asked him who he was, and whence he came, and why he uttered such words, he made no matter of reply to what he said, but still did not leave off his melancholy ditty, till Albinus took him to be a madman and dismissed him." Now, as you no doubt have figured out by now, all five of these quotes sound like they're references to Jesus. But actually, the first four are referring to an important religious figure who lived sometime around 100 BC. And the last quote sounds like the interrogation of Jesus in the Gospels, down to him being silent as he's being whipped, and then being dismissed as a madman. But this is actually of a man named Jesus, son of Annas, and he died in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed, 40 years after Jesus is believed to be crucified. So the question is, what's going on here? Are people taking the Jesus stories and applying them to other people? Well, to answer that, let's go ahead and take a look at our sources. The first quote I gave you was from the Sefer Todoth Yeshu. Now, this is a kind of anti-gospel that was compiled sometime between 300 and 700 AD. It was first mentioned in 826. Now, it was written by Jews as a kind of parody against Christianity. And even though the story gives a lot of miracles given by Jesus, he's still put out to be a kind of charlatan in the end, and only was able to do all these miracles because he stole the name of God. Now, this is probably surprising to a lot of people, and you wonder, well, why don't we know anything about it? It was because it was prohibited by the Catholic Church in the early 1500s. In fact, the story has a note attached to it in Slavic Hebrew that warns that you can copy it, but don't print it, and don't speak about it in front of young girls or the frivolous, and especially not in front of Christians. The story begins by saying that Jesus, or Yeshu, was born in the days of King Janus, and that his birthday was 93 BC. Now, in this version of the story, Jesus isn't crucified on a Roman cross. He's actually stoned by his fellow Jews, and then he's hung up on a tree. And after that, he's then buried in Judas's garden. And when that happens, a lot of his followers come to go see him, and when they do that, they start stepping on all of Judas's vegetables, like his lettuce. Now, this, of course, sounds silly and probably sounds like it's derivative of the Gospels. After all, the Gospels were written earlier, right? Problem with that is there are elements in this version of the story that pop up before it's believed to have been written. For instance, Tertullian, who's the first Latin Christian author, mentions that the Jews believed that Jesus' body was taken away because the gardener got sick of Christians walking on his lettuce. Now, this is the early 200s, which is pretty early. We also have in the 300s, which is around the same time that the Orthodox Christian Church was established by Emperor Constantine, Saint Epiphanius, who was a heresiologist, was writing against other Christian heresies, and while he was doing that, he says that Jesus was born in Bethlehem during the days of Janus Alexander, and that it had to be that way because Jesus, in fact, took on the mantle of kingship that failed after Alexander died. Well, the problem with that is he goes on to say that this was, you know, very soon before the time of Herod the King, which is completely wrong. Alexander lived 100 years before King Herod. Now, it can be argued that just because this belief is found in one anti-gospel and in the writings of one Christian saint doesn't make it a popular belief. There were a lot of heretical beliefs about Jesus at the time. But if we look into some medieval Jewish chronicles, we find a 12th century Spanish philosopher named Abraham Mendoud. And he wrote that all Jewish history writers believed that Jesus lived during the time of King Janus Alexander, and that they all believed that his teacher was Joshua ben Perakiah, which matches up with the Sefer Todoth Yeshu. In fact, the Todoth Yeshu says that they both went to Egypt, similar to the way Jesus is in Egypt as a little kid in the Gospel of Matthew. Now let's move on to my second quote, the one that says, "For, O people in Zion who dwell in Jerusalem, surely you shall not weep anymore." This is actually from the Isaiah Pesher from the Dead Sea Scrolls. These were documents found near the Dead Sea and the ruins of Qumran. They're believed to have been written by a Jewish sect named the Essenes, and they had a teacher named the Teacher of Righteousness. They never gave a proper name for him, and he takes on a lot of the same kind of roles that Jesus does. For example, there's a fragment called Fragment 7 of the Slain Messiah text. It's pretty cut up, but I'll try to manage through it. It says, "Isaiah the prophet, the scepter shall go forth from the root of Jesse," who's the father of David. Goes on to say, "Branch of David, and they shall be judges. And they put to death the leader of the community," which must be the Teacher of Righteousness, "with piercing, and the priest shall command the slain of the Romans." There have been a lot of people who've made connections between these scenes and Christianity. But for the most part, most scholars try to dismiss it out of hand and just say that these are just another Jewish sect amongst many, and Jesus is just, was at the time just a very small portion of the same overall giant messianic group. But we still see a lot of strange parallels between gospel writings and these Essene writings. Now, the third quote that I gave came from the Babylonian Talmud, a collection of Jewish writings. The earliest of these is known as the Mishnah from the 200s, and the prayer that I quoted comes from Teyanet 23a, called Honi's Prayer. Honi also lived in the 1st century BC and was known as Honi the Circle Drawer because he would often draw a circle and pray inside it to make rain come. The Mishnah tells how one time he prayed so long that it caused a flood, and there was a very important rabbi at the time named Simon ben Shetach, who was brother to Queen Salome, wife of Janus Alexander. After the flood, Simon sent Honi a message saying, if it had not been him who had acted so petulant before God, he would have excommunicated him. But as it says, but what shall I do to you? For you act like a spoiled child before God, and he does your will for you, like a son who acts like a spoiled child with his father, and he does his will for him. Simon ben Shetach is also the Pharisee who has Yeshu captured and killed in the Sefer Todeth Yeshu, so there may, in fact, be a connection. In the Gospels, Simon Peter turns away from Jesus and denies him shortly before his death. This may be symbolic of Simon ben Shetach turning away from Honi and allowing his enemies to kill him. Josephus talks about him as well, calling him the righteous man, or a righteous man, which seems to match up with both the teacher of righteousness and also the New Testament, which also refers to Jesus as the righteous one. According to him, Honi tried to hide himself before the Passover, just as Yeshu did in the Todeth Yeshu, and just as Jesus did in the Gospel of John. But Honi's captured by one of the two warring factions, and each one of them is led by one of the sons of Janus Alexander, after both of them had died. When the side that captured him demands for him to bless the troops that are under siege, he calls out for God not to listen to either side, since they were all his children, and this causes them to stone him to death. The Mishnah also tells a story about how Honi talks to a man planting a carob tree, and it says that carob trees only grew fruit after a 70-year wait. Honi asks the man why he's doing it, and the man tells him that he's doing it for his children. And Honi questions the wisdom of this as he falls asleep underneath the tree. And then 70 years later, he wakes up, like Rip Van Winkle, and he sees the man's grandson harvesting the carobs, just like he said. But when he goes to town, he learns that his followers don't believe that he is who he says he is, and this causes him to wish for death. The fact that he fell asleep under a tree may be symbolic of him being hung there, and his followers not understanding who he is later may be an attempt to make fun of Christians not understanding where their founder came from. In another part of the Midrash, the Sanhedrin 43a, it says that Yeshu was hung on the Sabbath at Passover, and this also matches up with the date that's given in the Gospel of John. It also matches up with the time period Honi was stoned to death. The Mishnah goes on to say that exceptions had been made for him because of some political or religious authority. Yeshu from the Sefer Todeth Yeshu had political authority as well because he was a relative of the queen. Honi, or Onias as Josephus calls him, had some religious authority because he probably came from the bloodline of the same Honi family that once claimed authority over the Second Temple before the Jewish Hasmonean dynasty took control over it, as told in the Book of Maccabees and Josephus' histories. Moving on to my fourth quote. This is the one about the death of Socrates, the death of Pythagoras being compared to the death of the Jews' wise king. Now, this was written by Mera ben Serapion, who was in Assyrian jail at the time. No one's really sure exactly when it was written, But a lot of people think that this is referring to Jesus. And the problem with that is that it says that shortly after this wise king was killed, the Jewish kingdom was abolished. Well, the problem with that is the Jewish kingdom was abolished long before Jesus was alive. That's pretty obvious from any movie you see where there's Romans in the city. But people who say that just kind of assume that, well, what they really meant to say was when this is a reference to the rebellion when the Romans came again and destroyed the temple. But that isn't really what it said. It says their kingdom was abolished. There really wasn't a kingdom during the rebellion because there were so many fighting factions. You couldn't really call it a kingdom at all. So if this is a reference to Jesus, this would have to be a reference to a Jesus of an earlier time, before the Jesus of the Gospels. Now, the obvious question is why? Why would the Gospel writers place a 1st century BC Jesus into a 1st century AD context? I believe the answer is the destruction of the temple. The destruction of Jerusalem and the Second Temple, while completely overshadowed by the death of Jesus in Christian tradition, was an incredible tragedy for all Jews at the time, and opened up a new question of how Jews were supposed to follow the laws of Moses without a centralized place to sacrifice. The first gospel writer, who wrote Mark, explained the destruction of the temple by paralleling it with the death of their teacher. This is made clear by the ripping of the temple curtain at the moment of Jesus' death. There are other details that connected also. Everyone knows the story of Simon the Cyrenian, who bears the cross of Jesus for a while. But what people don't know is that there was also a Jewish rebellion in Cyrene only 3 years after the one in Jerusalem, which was put down by Emperor Vespasian the same way he did to Jerusalem. So, in a way, Simon bearing the cross is symbolic of the Cyrenians bearing the same cross that Jerusalem did. There's also the darkness at Jesus' death, which lasted several hours. People usually try to look for a solar eclipse at the time, but none at the time could have been seen in Jerusalem, not during Passover, nor any other time, and certainly not for several hours, which would be impossible. But the darkness can be explained as a metaphor for the darkness that no doubt would have enveloped Jerusalem while the temple was actually burning. This brings us to the final quote, in which Jesus, son of Annas, is speaking out to the people of Jerusalem in warning shortly before the temple is destroyed. The Gospel of Jesus brings with him the same warnings to Jerusalem, and like this other Jesus, he's captured and whipped without complaint, and then nearly released as a madman. I believe this story was used by Mark or an earlier Gospel writer as inspiration for the Passion narrative, and that the procurator Albinias was replaced by Pontius Pilate, who was well known at the time for his antagonism towards the Jews. Instead of just letting him go as the Josephus story has it, the Gospel writer added a decree that the Romans would allow one prisoner to be released during Passover, which, of course, is completely unsupported by any historical evidence. Instead of choosing the peaceful Jesus, they choose a terrorist named Barabbas, sometimes called Jesus Barabbas, whose name means Son of the Father. This is a pretty obvious metaphor for explaining why Jerusalem was destroyed. Instead of choosing Jesus, the people of Jerusalem chose the zealot freedom fighters who waged war on Rome for independence. These zealot warriors were backed up by Jewish assassins named the Sicarii. Judas's surname, Iscariot, appears to be a reference to this Sicarii faction, and the character Judas is even portrayed as such in the film Last Temptation of Christ. Symbolically, this could represent the Sicarii betraying the people of Jerusalem by bringing the Romans down upon them, and by doing so, they in fact hung themselves as well, just as Judas hung himself in the Gospel of Matthew. Now, what about the other writings of the New Testament? There are also the epistles, which are letters, that were written before the Gospels. But the surprising thing is, if you read the epistles apart from the Gospels, as all Christians before 70 AD would have done, you'll find there's surprisingly little about Jesus, the historical person. Names like Joseph, the Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene, Judas Iscariot, John the Baptist, Herod, Lazarus, Mary and Martha, Mary the mother of James the Lesser, Salome, Joseph of Arimathea, Stephen, and all but three of the possible disciples failed to get mentioned in any of the epistles, including Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Jude. Names of people aren't the only thing that's missing either. There's also no mention of Bethlehem, Nazareth, Capernaum, Cana, Galilee, the Garden of Gethsemane, or the hill of Christ's crucifixion, Golgotha, also known as Calvary. The name Pontius Pilate appears only in the one late pastoral epistle, the first epistle of to Timothy, which was probably written in the 2nd century, as most scholars agree. Now, that's not to say that the epistles are without descriptions of Paul's social circle. A vast network of apostolic work can be unearthed from the world of information given about Paul and his contacts. But this world is stunningly divorced from the world of the Gospel of Jesus. Names unfamiliar to the Gospels are rattled off in the epistles, but none of these people appear to have any links to Jerusalem or Nazareth. Only Turkey, Greece, and Alexandria. Now, people assume that Paul learned everything he knew from the disciples of Jesus, but in fact the letters attributed to Paul repeatedly deny this. Over and over again it says that Paul received his teachings from God through the Holy Spirit. Not only that, but in the epistle to the Galatians it says that Paul was actually in contention with a man named Cephas, whose name is normally retranslated as Peter. Now, one might think that there would be no debate as to who is the more authoritative source, a former disciple of Jesus or a man who used to persecute Christians. But in fact, the letters attributed to Paul repeatedly argue that he's just as authoritative as those he mocks as super apostles. The fact that he doesn't even call them disciples have led some scholars to think that Paul was trying to hide the fact to promote his own importance. But really, how could anyone get by with that? What's far more likely is that James, John, and Cephas really were only other apostles, who, like Paul, received their authority from visions. And they only became disciples of Jesus through gospel metaphor. In fact, there's good reason to believe that the epistles were written during a time when their conception of Jesus was the same as the first century BC Jesus. For one thing, in 1 Thessalonians, it's the Jews who were said to have killed Jesus without any mention of the Romans. Some scholars think that this must have been a later edition, written by anti-Semitic Christians, you know, later on. But there's also the fact that there's no mention of a Roman cross. Modern translations say that Jesus was crucified, but in fact the word in Greek for crucified is the same for hung, and the epistles continuously say that Jesus was hung on a tree. Now, most people believe that this is just symbolic and that's the Gospels that are historic, but when combined with all the other evidence, it seems clear to me that they've got it backwards. It's the historic Jesus who was hung on a tree, and it's a metaphoric Jesus who was hung on a Roman cross, echoing the thousands of Jews who were crucified in Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, this is all really only a small token of the evidence I've amassed. You can read the rest of it at lost-history.com or cryph.com, cryph.com. If you'd like to send me any comments, you can email me at lost.history@yahoo.com.